go out and buy something. Yes. As if that was going to assuage that spiritual gap, that spiritual void in us. And in some of the ways that you point out how we've got both a failure of large relationships with our leaders, down to the relationship with ourselves, it talks about how that whole materialistic me first attitude has pervaded. Is that part of, well, I don't want to say the driving force, but how would you say that kind of interacts with what you're saying with magnifying that spirit of fear?
Well, I think that the fearful energy does lead people to want something to make them feel safe and secure.
Mm-hmm.
And one level that they get that safety and security is through the fantasy of, well, we'll just be as powerful as everybody else. And that, so we're going to have a tough army, and we're going to go bomb a whole countries. We're going to take over countries in the Middle East. That'll give us our safety and security. And hence we get the Afghanistan war and then the Iraq war. But another level of it is, here, I need to have something material in my hands, and this is going to be my safety and security. And there is a deep spiritual fantasy going on of that somehow we're going to achieve permanence in this life, when actually the truth of the matter is, and this is a deep spiritual truth, all of us are going to die. All of us are going to die. All of us are going to die. And
yes.
And all the fantasies that people have, whether it's the fantasy of, I'm going to be the most famous entrepreneur in the country. I'm going to be the most famous songwriter in the country. I'm going to be the most famous basketball player in the country. I'm going to have the biggest house. I'm going to be able to give all my wealth to my children. Whatever it is, none of it is going to actually work to eliminate the truth that we're all going to die, that we're impermanent, that we're here for a short amount of time, and that the question is, what do we want to really do with our time? And if it's to accumulate objects, we're in a fantasy world because they're not going to last. You can't take them with you, etc. But whereas if we can build a world of love and caring and generosity, of kindness, of peace and justice, then we can leave this life believing that we've actually done something of significance, that we've transcended self, and recognize that self is very temporary on this planet. So there's a spiritual dimension to human needs that's very, very critical, and the capitalist marketplace and our leadership says, don't worry about that. What you should worry about is accumulating things, and things are really important. So
things are really important. Now, some of our listeners are probably saying, okay, I agree with what you're saying so far, but in terms of the critique of our society and economic system. But this spiritual thing, I'm sure people, their eyes are rolling over.
Yes,
as a sort of gaining an understanding, I think your own personal history is informative for our listener in terms of your own development, in terms of your activism and your need to critique religion both on the left and the secularism on the right.
Yes. Well, of course, my first real synthesis of that was encountering Martin Luther King Jr. and being at the March on Washington in 1963. And then being inspired by him and seeing that religion, which I had been interested in before in a private way, also had a dramatic consequence, at least one strand of religion, the strand that integrated a progressive vision with a spiritual vision that Martin Luther King Jr. and the African-American church did so well. But when I became an activist in the left in the 1960s, after that, I was president of the Students for Democratic Society at Berkeley from 1966 to 68. And then after that, I taught at the University of Washington and was indicted by the Justice Department, by the Nixon Justice Department, and I was sent to federal penitentiary for having organized anti-war demonstrations. The laws that I was sent to prison in were eventually overturned, but I was one of what was called the Seattle Seven. And all through that period, I was an activist and a leader in the left. In fact, J. Edgar Hoover said that I was one of the most dangerous criminals in America. And that was what his argument for why I shouldn't be let out of prison to the federal appeals court. All that time, I was constantly encountering tremendous pressure not to be religious or spiritual, to separate those two things, because in the white left, as opposed to the African American left, it was considered really a stunting of intellectual and psychological growth. And what I found when I started to interview people for this book, The Left Hand of God, spoke to them about why they were moving politically to the right, a very large number of the people who were moving to the right in part because there was a real spiritual crisis in their lives. And when they tried to talk about that in the left, they were made to feel that they were either stupid or at least at a lower level of intellectual or psychological development. Maybe they had a problem with their father figure. Maybe they had they were looking for an authority figure. Maybe they had not that they were fleeing from freedom and they wanted some authority to tell them how to live. That's what they were told by other people on the left, that you know you can't be on a high level of intellectual sophistication and be really one of us when you're believing in God or when you're having some kind of spiritual life. So I began to realize that this was a tremendous detriment to the left. It wasn't just my personal experience, but the whole way that the liberal and progressive world conveyed the message that you're not really welcome here, or we need your vote. You might be welcome. We need your vote, but we don't really think that you're like the rest of us who are so much more sophisticated and intellectually developed, because we know that all that spiritual and religious stuff is pure crap. So that has been one of the things that I discovered in this research, that people have been pushed away from the left, in part because there is a real spiritual crisis in their life, and in part because that the left doesn't address, and in part because the whole culture of the left is hostile to anybody who takes that level of spiritual or religious truth seriously.
It is 8 o'clock in the morning here at KBOO FM 90.7. We're on More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste, speaking with Rabbi Michael Lerner. And you brought up the point of the left, the progressive movement, and I'll use these kind of interchangeably, has a deep aversion. Aversion might even be a strong word. I think maybe just to say they're really skeptical. But yet at the same time, there is a belief system that you bring out in your book that they do embrace. And is it possible that maybe it takes just a subtle shifting, if you will, of perspective to be able to see the points that you've just made here and now?
Uh-huh. Yes. Yes, that's
correct. How would you articulate that little subtle shift of position?
Well, I think the first thing that people on the left have to get is that we too on the left have a religious or spiritual system. That it's not that there's a more rational foundation for us than for anybody else. We have our belief system, and very often when you push somebody on the left, they'll say, "Of course, I have this belief. For example, that peace is better than war, or that that social justice is better than social injustice." And when you ask them, "How do you justify that?" they end up saying something to the effect of, "Well, I just know it. I know it in my bones. I know it intuitively." Because when they're talking about rationality and why religion and spirituality is baloney, what they usually do is they refer to the dominant system in the society that says that which is real is that which can be verified through sense observation, or that can be measured. And if it can't be measured, or if you can't see it, touch it, feel it, or whatever, and you can't get people around you to see the same thing at the same time, then it's not really real. But then when you ask them, "Well, then what's the measurement that you have for saying that justice is better than injustice?" Or what's the sense observation that you have? In other words, where's the scientific proof that social justice is better than social injustice? They don't have any scientific proof. Of course not, because that social justice is a spiritual vision. They don't get that their own thing is an ethical spiritual vision that is based on their own intuitions about the right and the wrong, and the so they think that they're on a higher level, but they're not. I mean, I'm not putting down people for this. On the contrary, I'm saying that every belief system is a belief system, and instead of putting down people who have a different belief system than us on the grounds that they're believers, mm-hmm. let's say, okay, I don't agree with those who believe that it's better for the rich to be made more rich than for the rich to share what they have with other people. That's a different intuition that I have. I want to argue with people on that ground. But what often you hear in the left is people coming forward and saying, oh, no, 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 they're irrational. We're on this higher rationality level because, and it's not true. It's not that we're on a higher rationality level. It's that we have a different belief system, and let's be recognized that ours was also a belief system, and then not put down people who have belief systems. Instead, let's argue the content of the belief systems. Do you see what I'm saying? It's like, let's argue, is this a better world to have people who share their wealth than to not? Is this a better world to have ecological foundations than not? But if somebody comes forward with a belief system, we're not going to put them down for having a belief system, because we have a belief system too that is no more scientifically validated than their belief system. So see, what the left has is this fantasy that at the bottom we're really irrational and everybody else is really irrational. And the truth of the matter is no, we have a belief system. I think it's a better belief system. I mean, I like our belief system. I want to argue for it. I want to show other people who disagree with it why it might be, even within their own terms, that they might come to see what's good in our belief system. But I don't want to argue it from the standpoint of, hey, we're the rational ones. Everybody else is the irrational ones. And there's that elitism that exists in the left, in which implicitly we're saying, well, we're on a higher plane than everybody else. I often hear this when they say something like this. Well, you know, we're for a multiplicity of views, and we're for compromise and tolerance of other views. But what the right wing comes forward and says, well, that's fine. That's your religion. You're allowed to have tolerance for, tolerance is your religion. Ours is, whatever. But tolerance is also a worldview. It's not on a higher plane than any other. It's a worldview. No, it's my worldview. I'm for it. But I'm not for it because I'm the rational one and everybody else is irrational. So I want to talk to other people who disagree with me and try to show them what would be so nice about a world, what would be so good about a world that had tolerance and had a multiplicity of voices and had multiculturalism and so forth. I don't want to say to them, you have to be less intelligent than I if you don't agree with me.
We're speaking this morning with Michael Lerner, the author of The Left Hand of God, Taking Back Our Country from the Religious Right. In a few moments, we will open our lines for your questions and comments. You not only offer this analysis and argue that those on the left should recognize their own belief system and argue for it. I think you do something very interesting in your book in one section. You said, I know about the 2008 Republican nominee. I know where, I was going to say he, it might be she. But I know where he stands. Uh-huh. I know the issues he stands on, and you can lay it down, you know, on terms of you know, the war in Iraq, on abortions, on Social Security. You say, but the Democrats, you have no idea. We don't know where the 2008 Democratic nominee stand for, and you argue in your book for the Democrats to show their true colors.
Well, or to get some true
get
colors.
Get some true colors, actually.
Yeah, so what you see, the thing is that, I mean, this book, The Left Hand of God, isn't only an attempt to talk about the spiritual crisis in American society and why the left doesn't understand it and why we need to understand it. Because it's fundamental to what's going on in politics today that I interviewed for this book over 10,000 people who were moving politically to the right. Now, I'm not talking about hardcore rightists who were born in fundamentalist families. I'm talking about people who were Democratic Party voters who have been subsequently moved to the right. And I was asking them why. And it was about the spiritual crisis in their lives. But definitely one of the sub-themes that came up was this feeling of that they wanted to know where somebody stood and wanted to know that people had a backbone. And the Democrats have not projected a backbone. They've projected a sense that they can read polls and and they can switch what they're saying depending on what they think is the latest thing in the polls. So what I do here is see, because I support a lot of the left. I mean, I'm not some turncoat who ran away from liberal and progressive politics, or and I'm not one of those people who's saying, "Hey, let's become like the right in respect to let's abandon civil rights, let's abandon the struggle to end sexism, let's abandon the struggle to end homophobia, let's abandon choice." That's not where I'm coming from. I'm somebody who wants to accept and strengthen all the parts of the progressive movement, but at the same time say we need a unifying theme and a set of core values that are clear and articulated, and that's what I do in this book. Is besides laying out what I've learned from them, I put forward in this book the vision of this new national organization that I've been working on with Cornel West and with Sister Joan Chittister. It's called the Network of Spiritual Progressives, and we're having a national conference in Washington May 17th to 20th to bring people from all over the country to create a spiritual left. Spiritual, by the way, does not necessarily mean religious. We're not only for people who believe in God. We're for anybody who recognizes that there's a spiritual dimension of human reality that is not reducible to material things. And that so we're putting together this kind of organization. And part of what we've done in the book is to put forward a spiritual covenant with America that lays out some 8 different specific points. But the unifying point is this. The unifying point is we need a new bottom line in America. We need a new definition of productivity, efficiency, and rationality. Because right now, institutions are judged efficient, rational, and productive only to the extent that they maximize money and power. And we're saying it's got to not only be about money and power, but when we judge an institution, a corporation, a government practice, a school system, whatever it is that we're looking at in our lives, we're not going to judge it anymore only by how much money and power it generates, but also how much love and caring, how much kindness and generosity, how much ethical and ecological sensitivity, how much it teaches us to respond to other human beings as embodiments of the sacred and not just as people to get something from, and how much it encourages us to respond to the universe with awe and wonder and radical amazement at the grandeur of creation. Now, this is a unifying vision for a progressive movement that through which we could articulate a very radical politics, but in a spiritual discourse that speaks across left-right boundaries and speaks to many people who have moved to the right but actually want a world of love and caring. Now, the thing is that one of the parts of that is to be able to be, you know, some people might say, oh, well, this is very airy-fairy, love, caring, generosity, kindness. But if you stand strong with it and you really take that seriously, then it doesn't have to be weak at all. The problem with the Democrats is that they're liberal about their liberalism. That is, they don't stand up and fight for it. Instead, they wimp out. And then people say, I don't feel secure with these people, with these Democrats. And it's not so much because of the content of what they're saying, is that they keep on switching what they're saying. You know, see,
it makes them look duplicitous.
Well, they are duplicitous. I mean, that's the whole thing about this past election with Kerry.
Yes.
People, I talk about what I learned in the analyzing with people about why they got so angry at the Democrats around Kerry, because most Democrats didn't believe in this war, and yet they nominated a candidate who did believe in the war. Now, why did they do that? They did that because they said to themselves, you know, the American people are too stupid or too morally corrupt to ever come to our anti-war position. So instead, we're going to put somebody forward who doesn't agree with us, who supports the war, and then they'll vote for this guy, and at least we'll win the election. And then a lot of people were saying in their hearts, But we're hoping afterwards that John Kerry, who's now, when he's running, is saying that his solution to Homeland Security, he's going to track down every terrorist on the planet and kill them, which is what he said in the debates with Bush, that actually that's just, he's just tricking people to show how tough he is. But when it comes to it, we believe that he's really the John Kerry who stood up and against the war in Vietnam back in 1971. And so we're hopeful that when afterwards he's going to change what he said. But what do the Republicans come forward and say? They say, this guy's a flip-flopper. And what are we thinking in our hearts? We're thinking, he's a flip-flopper. That's why we voted for the guy, is because we're thinking he's a flip-flopper and that he's lying to the American public to win. And then afterwards, he'll switch and be against the war instead of for the war, and that he's just doing this to trick people. Well, how can people respect a party that thinks that the way to win power is to put up somebody who says the opposite of what they believe because they're too afraid to stand for what they stand for? So then you feel like, yeah, they got no backbone. And these are the people who are supposed to give us security. They're going to provide us homeland security. They're going to provide us defense. So that doesn't mean my answer then is, let's get a real warmonger. Not at all, because in one of the eight planks of this spiritual covenant with America that I put forward in my book, The Left Hand of God, is that the way to achieve homeland security is for the United States to take 5% of our gross domestic product and use that every year for the next 20 years and to lead the other G8 countries in the same direction to eliminate global poverty, homelessness, hunger, inadequate education, inadequate health care. Because if we do that, we will have far more homeland security and far more power in the world than we will get by these crazy wars like the war in Iraq, in which all we do is generate more hatred and build up more terrorists in the world. So instead of taking our trillions of dollars that we spend each year on national defense, take a significant part of that and end global poverty. And that, now, that's a, here's the Republican response. Oh, you guys are such wimps. You don't know how to stand up. But the truth is, if we turn it around and said, hey, you know what? You guys have given us, for the last 5,000 years, your type of person has said that we're going to end wars by more wars. We're going to get security by being tough and beating up the other guy. And, you know, it hasn't worked. After 5,000 years, would you please admit that your strategy isn't working? Give us 50 years to try a different strategy, a strategy of generosity in which we will end global hunger, homelessness, and poverty, inadequate education, inadequate health care, and we promise you, we'll get more security than you've ever gotten. Now, if instead of caving when they say, oh, you're weak on national defense, we come back and say, no, you're weak on national defense, you're sticking with a strategy that never works, we're tough on national defense, that's why we're willing to cut into our own incomes to end the real problem facing our world, which is this huge amount of poverty and oppression. In other words, stand up with a backbone. But the Democrats don't have a backbone, or at least they're fearful of showing their backbone. So it's the same thing. And then it's easy for the Republicans to say, well, would you trust these people with your national defense when they're just looking at the latest poll to figure out where they're going to be in the next election? So as you say, and I argue this in the book, we have no idea whether in the next election the Democratic candidate is going to be pro-choice or anti-choice, whether it's going to be did they vote to support the Iraq war or did they vote to oppose the Iraq war? Did they vote to continue to fund the Iraq war or did they vote to not continue to fund the Iraq war? We have no idea on a dozen other issues. Are they people who believe that the best interests of the United States are served by globalization of capital and the transfer of a lot of jobs from this country to other countries? Or do they believe in protecting jobs in this country? We have no idea where they're going to stand. And they probably don't either. They're just looking at waiting on the next poll.
And one thing that you mentioned, and maybe it's a philosophical question, in terms of these two contrasting vision of the world and how we ought to establish the world, is that those who believe in its love and generosity, the left hand of God, has a certain set of values, but you can't very much, for lack of a better term, battle those on the right hand of God with those same tactics. So how do you persuade or how does it become manifest without losing your soul?
Yes, well, kind of. The
being
first
co-opted.
Thing, yes, absolutely. Well, the first thing is, and this, a lot of what I argue in this book is around this, is that instead of thinking of people who move to the right as bad people or as stupid people, because so much of the discussion after the 2004 election was, why did we lose? We don't look at our own problems and what's wrong with us. Instead, we turn around and say, the American people are stupid. These people are either racist or sexist or homophobic. Instead of that, the first thing is to start listening to people with whom we disagree and to treat them as though they are also embodiments of the holy and that they also have something to teach us. In other words, so this is what this whole book, The Left Hand of God, does, is it listens to people who have moved to the right and tells their story, because their story is an important story. But that means that number one thing to do is overcome our elitism, our sense that everybody who doesn't agree with us is either stupid or racist or sexist or homophobic. Not to say that there aren't some racist, sexist, and homophobic people on the right, but most people who move to the right didn't move to the right for those reasons. They moved because there's a spiritual crisis. And I'd say the first thing, the first weapon in our arsenal has to be compassion and a spirit of generosity towards those with whom we don't agree. And I'd say the methodology, the critical methodology for a left or a progressive movement is this: always look to find what's the rational part in the irrational totality of people with whom you disagree with. Try to listen deeply enough so that even though this doesn't mean that we have to agree with their conclusions, okay, but it means trying to see if any part of what they're talking about is something legitimate. Is there something under, or if it's not talking about, then try to hear it more deeply. What is underlying their desires? So here is a rabbi. I started out in this inquiry by trying to understand the fascists in Germany who were murdering Jews, okay? And I'm saying, yes, we had to understand why, because the strategy of saying, hey, they're fascists, that ended us up in the concentration camps. It didn't save a single Jew. I wish there had been a movement in the 1920s in Germany that was listening to the right and listening to these fascists and saying, gee, you know, they're asking for some kind of, they're feeling very screwed over in the world. Now, their solutions to it are to kill us Jews. Well, that's not a good solution. But maybe there's something about why they're feeling so screwed over that we could address instead of just going to their conclusion, which is a racist or sexist conclusion, or in that case, an anti-Semitic conclusion, and saying, oh, well, these are all bad people. Instead say, yeah, some bad people there, but there are some people who are starting to listen to them that don't have to be listening to them, that we might be able to win away if we were to listen deeply enough to what are the underlying needs that are legitimate needs, even though they are taking an illegitimate form in the form of anti-Semitism in Germany, mm-hmm. or in the form of racism against Native Americans and African Americans here, or homophobia here, or whatever. Try to find, this is the methodology, try to find the kernel of decency in people and then figure out a way to speak to that in a non-repressive, non-racist, non-sexist, non-homophobic way and see how you can win people away from right-wing strategies that have been very hurtful.
You know, part of what you're saying basically is the same approach we really should have taken that many people advocated for right after the attack of 9/11. Just because we were compelled by our leadership to believe that this was a blanket hate that was manifested toward us, it didn't preclude the need to listen, like you said. And so often it seems that we are more reactive.
Right.
Instead of listening to people and responding.
Exactly. And so this mistake happens in both sides. In other words, instead of listening to the underlying needs, we focus on our opposition to the way it's manifest. Well, yeah, I hated what people did, the attacks on this country in 9/11. I'm not trying to justify it
right.
in any way. In fact, the right wing says if you start to listen to the underlying needs, you're just justifying it. But I hear that in the left now, the same thing. When I start talking about spiritual needs of people, they come back and say, wait a second, don't you realize these people are sexist or homophobic or racist? I'm saying, yeah, I realize that some of those policies are racist, sexist, and homophobic. I don't want to support them, but I want to figure out a way to win people away from that racism, sexism, and homophobia. And it's not by, and you can't do that unless you can find something underlying that made them decent human beings that can be spoken to in a non-racist, non-sexist, non-homophobic way. So you have a very good point what you just said, because when we look at the world and their anger and the anger that was expressed by those people who gave their lives, after all, for their principle, which was, I thought it was a disgusting act, but they were representing a great deal of resentment at the way in which United States wealth and power operates in the world. And if we could have said, that's not an appropriate way to express it, but there is something there to be heard.
There's a kernel of truth.
A kernel of truth that we better listen to, or else we're going to face more of this crap from them. That would have been a very smart way to go, but unfortunately, you weren't president then. I wish you had been. Instead, we had.
We've got what we have.
Yeah, exactly.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO Portland 90.7. And we've been speaking here with Rabbi Michael Lerner, discussing his book, The Left Hand of God, speaking of how the progressive movement in this country, not necessarily limited to the Democratic Party or as expressed by the Democratic Party, or what would the word be, manifested? Yeah, that's the one I'm looking for, manifested by the Democratic Party, but still needing to make some type of compelling and articulate a statement of belief, belief of position. We will take your phone calls here, and we're trying to do a little bit of organizing here. Okay, yeah, we got what we need. So you can give a call. You can have a conversation with Rabbi Lerner at 503-231-8187 here on More Talk Radio. And let's see, I'm trying to see. Can't see the high sign, I think. Is that the...
Do we have a phone call?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, thank you. Just be direct.
Hello.
Good morning. You're on the air.
Just a second. Good morning.
Hi.
Hi. You're on the air.
All right. I'm Wade. I have don't know where to begin quite. There's quite a bit there. I take it that you won't mind arguing with people that agree with you either, huh?
we'll argue with anybody.
Rabbi Lerner, Celeste and Cecil, it's a joy. I'm glad I'm here on your show. This is really, serendipitous? Let's see. I had just written something about, this is part two of why I love George Bush. I think it'll explain quite a bit and tie in quite well. I only just learned this. Check it out. This is the perfect day. It can be no other than I direct. And this is why. Hitler was so popular and later so despised only for this. He knew that he had energy and he used it. Now, that's a key word for destruction. Okay, he used it. Now, people were amazed at this talent at first and then... And voted in a democracy. This is remember this, okay? That was a democracy, and they voted in it, and again, until they couldn't vote no more, okay? Hint, hint. George Bush can direct whatever he wants, but he cannot direct or ever represent us unless we let him. People, get a grip. Now, I hear your fears. A cacophony of tears fools all to cry about something we can stop any time. Now, there is a time to cry to heal, but there is also times ad infinitum when wailing, complaining, whining is preventing healing. Make up your heart, mind, and stop a so-called tragedy in its tracks. So I'll actually give you a start of where I'm coming from. You mentioned that you were from a Students for a Democratic Society, and that, according to the FBI, is called the SDS. Is that correct?
It was by us called the SDS.
And I wonder if any callers are being struck with fear with just the name of that and how many times it appeared with bombs and blown-up buildings and such, you know.
Well, that was their fantasy. We were not a bomb-throwing group. We were nonviolent. We were confrontational.
Yes.
We sat in. We challenged the war in Vietnam. But it was only a small little group of people who, in 1970, a handful of people who engaged in acts of violence against property and And amongst them, there were probably two or three who ever had a bomb in their hand. I mean, it was a fantasy that the media and the government constructed to discredit a mass movement. The SDS had, at its height, 100,000 members. But I didn't come here to talk about SDS. I came here to talk about a network of spiritual progressives that we are building right now.
I thought I was doing that, too. Like, no, but it sounds like you still have a lot of faith in this political system. I used to, but...
I have a lot of faith in the American people.
Yeah.
I think there are a lot of very good people here.
When it's combined with a spiritual sense, it'll work. But until then, it's only going to be greed. It's going to descend. I mean, it's just... Right? I mean, there's just way too much money in there. If you don't have a spiritual bent, then it's not going to work out well, can it? Do you think so? I mean...
Well, that's why we're trying to build a spiritual left, a network of spiritual progressives, which, by the way, you can check out on the web at www.spiritualprogressives.org, or you can come hear me speak at Powell's. I'm speaking at Powell's at 7:30 on Tuesday night, so that's open to the public, and I'll be signing copies of my book, The Left Hand of God, Taking Back Our Country from the Religious Right.
There, then. What night? Tuesday at what time?
7:30.
And is it downtown or out here in Beaverton?
I'm downtown.
Downtown.
Thank you so much for the pleasure and the ability, and thank you, Spirit, for letting us all be together again.
All right, well, thank you for your call.
And for those of you who are interested in hearing Rabbi Lerner, he'll speak in Eugene at Temple Beth Israel
tonight.
And,
and I don't know how that's going to happen, but I'm getting out. I hope the roads aren't snowing.
They shouldn't be snowing. We're having good weather here.
2 hours, you'll get there.
You'll get there.
And we'll go to our next caller. Good morning, and thank you for waiting.
Hello. I've been hearing a lot about the government wanting us to live in fear of terrorism and that, and the government and other like people who support war and that. But, you know, a lot of people in this country like me have a personal reality that is reasonable for us to live in fear. Fear is uncomfortable and unhealthy, but I think it's valid. And people's lives, like my life, I'm poor, I'm old, I have lousy energy, I have lousy health, I don't have any support systems, and they're attacking the government, and those are attacking and breaking down the systems we have to live on for money and housing and food and health care, and they're attacking this, the government, whoever, are attacking these systems. So I think it's reasonable for people like me to live in a reasonable amount of fear. Our lives are being broken down. Mm-hmm.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
Okay, so I wanted to say that. Thank you.
Yes, well, you've got a very good point there. And a part of that, you see, what we're asking is, how does it happen when most people don't really want that to happen? When there's a very large number of people who would love to see a decent healthcare system that would take care of you and take care of everyone else, how does it happen that we have a government that doesn't want to do that and in fact is committed to cutting the taxes on the rich meanwhile defunding the programs for the poor? So it's in trying to deal with that I did this study to try to understand how come people who are voting for a government like that, even when it's against their economic interests. And what I found is that there is a spiritual hunger in people for some kind of different life that they never hear that addressed in the liberal or progressive world. They go to the right-wing world because that's where the people are talking about this issue of spirituality, of the spiritual hunger. And by the way, in my book, The Left Hand of God, I try to show that the actual source of the spiritual crisis is in the world of work and in the economy, and that if you actually want to change the materialism and selfishness, we have to change the economic system that we're living in. And I have some very specific ideas there about how to do that. But in order for us to actually change this government in any significant way, we're going to have a group of people who are willing and open to talk about the spiritual crisis in American society. And it's if anybody comes along and says, well, wait a second, don't you think first you should solve the social problems, the economic problems of, for example, the poor? My answer is, yes, go and do it. If you can do it, if your plan has been working, if the liberal and progressive movement have been successful, great. You don't need me. You don't need any of this stuff. But guess what? You haven't been. For the last 50 years, there were times when we had a president that was a Democrat, we had a Congress that was a Democrat, and we didn't have elimination of poverty. We didn't have a creation of a health care system. We didn't have all of these changes. Well, why not? Well, it turns out that people were not unified in a vision of what they really wanted, and they couldn't demand it. We need a different vision, and we need to not only have that vision articulated, but we need a social force that can make that happen. And what I'm saying to my brothers and sisters in the liberal and progressive movement is, we will never have that unless we change our attitude towards the religious and spiritual people and create a context within which spiritual and religious people are welcomed on the left rather than put down. That doesn't mean, I'm not here saying, hey, everybody on the left has to believe in God, or hey, everybody on the left has to start a spiritual practice. Not at all. Just like gays and lesbians, when they came to the left, they didn't say, hey, everybody has to be gay. What they said is, stop your homophobia in the left. Stop treating us as though we're second-class citizens. Stop having humorous jokes about us. Stop making us feel like basically you share the same contempt as the rest of the society for us. Well, that's what we're saying for a spiritual vision. Start to realize the people who have a spiritual vision may actually have something to teach the left that's of value to the left, not just you need our votes, but that there's actually something here in a liberal and in a spiritual vision that's valuable to you. And part of that is recognizing this hunger for a framework of meaning and purpose for life, that people don't only want money, they also want meaning. And that the purpose-driven life, Rick Warren wrote this book that 25 million copies have just been sold in the last 2 years about the purpose-driven life. And why? Because people feel like they are wasting their life in a world of work. They work day in and day out to enrich somebody else, because the bottom line is money and power, and they're enriching the corporations that they work for, but they never get an opportunity, or very rarely get an opportunity, to feel that their life is about something that they really personally believe in, that they're contributing to the common good, or that they're contributing to some higher vision of the good that they believe in. So people come home from the world of work day in and day out feeling like they've wasted their life. Well, then they want more money for it, because they figure, well, if I'm wasting my life, at least I'd like
a little bit of compensation.
I want to be compensated. I want to have something so that in my few hours outside the world of work, or maybe when I retire, I could shape something for myself that would feel decent, instead of having to spend my life working for institutions that I don't really believe in, that don't really share my highest values. Well, if a left began to talk about that, instead of just talking about economic entitlement and political rights, if we started to talk about the hunger for meaning and purpose, and why, in order to get that, we're going to need to change the economy. In other words, not just go to church, because what we're saying is, no, don't just go to church. Bring those spiritual values into the economy, and let's challenge an economic life that doesn't allow for higher values. Let's get a new bottom line. And that's the essence of the central vision of this book, The Left Hand of God, Taking Back Our Country from the Religious Right. And that's why I think in the last 3 weeks since it's been issued, it's suddenly become a national bestseller, because people get it, that there is a hunger for something deeper than material well-being, that there's a hunger also for a meaning, a transcendent meaning to one's life.
You can join in the conversation, 503-231-8187, and we'll go to our next caller. Good morning, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you so much for taking my call. And, you know, I start out with some thoughts when I dial the phone, and then I listen kind of to some things, and my thoughts get a little bit weird. But anyway, let me toss out a couple of things here. And, you know, I think what has happened, with the people, with the thinking to the far right, is that they are very frightened people. You know, it's all about religiosity, churchianity, and faithness. And really, inside of themselves, they have no faith, and they're looking to Big Daddy to help them find faith. And we have some raging maniacal psychotics in leadership positions who know this and know how to continue to manipulate this, and then we end up in the mess we're in. And I also would like, I think we need to look deeper than our state propaganda about 9-1-1, I think there's much more to that than the people who hate us. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. It's very convoluted and confusing, but I just want to have a bumper sticker sometime that says, there really is a they.
I like that. I like that.
Anyway, and we must keep that in mind. But I thank you so much. And we are bereft of spirit. It's sucked out of us. And this, like I say, this is what the psychotics know. They tell us that this is what we need as they're sucking it out of us. And when you cannot support yourself in this economy, then it's turned on you. Well, there's something the matter with you.
Mm-hmm.
What's the matter with you? You can't do it. You're bad. You don't have enough faith. God isn't good to you. He's good to me, but he isn't good to you. And, you know, I think we're just a mess. Mm. We're just a mess here, and it's a sad thing. And I will say that a global depression that's coming to us is only because, it's very simple, only because the rich have stolen too much from the poor. We know they've always skimmed off the top, but now it's just way overboard. And I don't know how does it happen that, you know, we can feed ourselves, for God's sake. Yeah. But anyway, thank you so much. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Well, thank you for your call.
We're speaking this morning with Rabbi Michael Lerner, who is the author of The Left Hand of God, Taking back
our country
from the religious right.
From the religious right. Yeah.
On number 0503-231-8187. And I think we have another caller.
Yes, we do.
And let's go to that caller. Good morning.
Good morning.
Am I on the air?
Yes, you are.
Well, thank you. Rabbi Lerner, one of my concerns is anti-Semitism and the perception of a lot of my friends on the left that the neocons are run by some, you know, rabid Zionist conspiracy, and that how do we differentiate, or how do we let people know that there is not a monolithic Zionist perception, and that that there are people of reason and people who care about other people, and that it is an inclusive world.
Yeah,
I'll take my answer off the air.
Yes, well, I certainly agree with you that I have encountered a lot of anti-Semitism recently in the left, in which people make these generalizations against all Jews, as though I've heard people claim that the war in Iraq is a Jewish war or something like that, and it's just nonsense. I mean, it would be like if you said, well, look, Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice, they're African-Americans. They've been the main spokespeople for this war. It's really an African-American war. I mean, what kind of crazy logic is that? Yes, there are Jews who have always thought throughout history that the way to protect Jews is to cuddle up to the ruling class, whoever it is, and try to serve them and then say, and in exchange, please protect us Jews. But most Jews have not supported that. And in fact, most Jews overwhelmingly oppose this war. If the rest of the country voted the way Jews voted, we would not have Bush administration, not the first time and not the second time. We had the Jews voted 80% Democratic in this last election. The only group that voted more Democratic than Jews are African Americans. So, you know, the notion of pinning this on the Jews and then saying it's a Jewish war, Jews are... But one of the things that we who are progressive Jews need to do inside the Jewish world is to challenge the right-wing leadership, because there is a right-wing leadership in many of the Jewish establishments, and right here in Portland even. I don't know all the details, but I know that in almost every Jewish community, you don't have the courage of the convictions of the base of Jews. The base of the Jews in Portland are liberal and progressive, but the leadership is often timid, not willing to stand up and articulate a strong progressive perspective, particularly in relationship to the war. And from my standpoint, as a critic of Israeli policy, I'm a strong supporter of Israel. I want Israel to exist and be strong. But the only way it's going to be exist and be strong is if there's a reconciliation between Israel and Palestine, an opening of the heart to the Palestinian people, and a spirit from the Jewish people that says, we recognize that our well-being depends on the well-being of the Palestinian people. Now, that's the same attitude I want for America towards the rest of the world. I want Americans to understand that the only way American can ever be strong and safe is when we understand that our well-being depends on the well-being of every other person on this planet, that there is no personal or private solution for the United States that doesn't involve the rest of the world and caring for the rest of the world. I don't hear that from the Democrats, and I don't hear that from the Republicans. I think that Democrats often think, no, in order to show that we are super patriotic, we've got to do this God bless America. Well, yeah, I want God bless America, but I want to live to see a president get up there and say, God bless America and every other country on this planet. God bless all the people of this planet. We are all interconnected, and we will only survive when we are able to see that and act with policies that are just as caring about the other as about ourselves.
We're speaking this morning with Rabbi Michael Lerner. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. He is working on establishing a national network of spiritual progressives. There will be a conference in Washington, D.C. this spring.
May 17th to May 20th. And let me say clearly, since I'm just speaking as a Jew, that this is an interfaith gathering, that it's co-chaired by Cornel West, the African-American professor of religious studies at Princeton, and by Sister Joan Chittister, the Dominican nun who is one of the outstanding feminists in the religious world. And we have this is taking place in Washington, D.C. to bring the message that you'll find in this book, The Left Hand of God, Taking Back Our Country from the Religious Right. We have in there a spiritual covenant with America that we are going to bring to our Congress people, and we need the people of Oregon to come there and to talk to your Congress people about a different vision for what American politics can be. But if you can't come there, join our organization, www.spiritualprogressives.org. Help us build a progressive spiritual force in this country. You don't have to believe in God. It's not about just people who believe in God. It's about anybody who recognizes the spiritual dimension of human reality and recognizes that a left needs to incorporate that in a central way.
And we'll go to our next caller.
Yes, good morning. You're on the air.
Well, good morning. Good morning. Shalom Aleichem, Rabbi. Thank you so, so much for sharing your wisdom with us this morning.
Aleichem Shalom.
Yeah, thank you, thank you. There are just a couple of quick points, Rabbi. I've been looking at this book called Politics, the Wellstone Way. It's kind of an outline of how to elect progressive people to positions of government. And one of the things that Wellstone said was, politics is not about money and it's not about power. It's about improving the quality of people's lives. Right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. That message seems to have gotten lost somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because the reality of America and American life is the bottom line. If you would just take a look around you. The war, for example, is a boon for the military industrial complex.
Yes, so that's why we're calling for, that's the central vision here, is for a new bottom line, so that institutions get judged efficient and rational and productive, not only to the extent that they maximize money and power, but also how much they maximize love and caring and kindness and generosity and ethical and ecological sensitivity. So, yeah, you're absolutely dead on. You've got the exact right point that is the central issue, is that there's the wrong bottom line. Paul Wellstone was a close friend of mine. He wrote regularly in my magazine, the Tikkun, T-I-K-K-U-N. He was one of the guiding forces for our magazine, in fact, and we talked frequently about strategy, and this I believe that I'm trying to carry on his legacy in this book and in building the network of spiritual progressives.
Right on. Okay, just one more quick thing, Rabbi. I'm first-generation American.
Yes.
My parents immigrated here from Eastern Europe. My dad had his choice of going to Auschwitz or coming to America.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I'm getting teary here. Anyway, my dad said, in America, anything is possible. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yes,
thank
well,
you for your call.
And let me say that I'm somebody who believes in America, believes in the American people, in the goodness of the American people, and I'm very proud to be an American because of the struggles that Americans have fought against their elites of power and have won very important advances for freeing the slaves, for ending apartheid, for struggling against racism, for struggling against sexism, for struggling against homophobia. I'm proud to be in a country where there's so many good people, so many people who are willing to struggle against our elites of power, and I'm hoping that this book, The Left Hand of God, Taking Back Our Country from the Religious Right, will help us be more successful in those struggles in the future.
In 1994, Newt Gingrich and the Republicans had their covenant with America. Have you had any success with the Democrats in terms of the spiritual covenant?
Well, you know, I was this book is only out for 3 weeks, and but I was on this NPR show, and there was a guy named Cummings, a Congressman Cummings, who is the former chair of the Black Caucus in the Congress. And he was very turned on by it and said that when we come to Washington, he's going to try to arrange for all of us who come to Washington to meet with the Democratic Caucus of the House and to put forward these ideas to the our elected representatives. So if anybody here in Oregon can come to Washington May 17th to 20th to be part of our conference, that would be terrific. But if not, we need a strong voice here in Portland and in Oregon. We need to have people organized in the network of spiritual progressives locally. So I hope people will read the book, create a study group around the book, share it with other people, and begin this discourse. And I think we can have a big impact on the Democratic Party, on the Greens. For all I know, we're not partisans, so we'd say, if you want to bring these ideas into the Republican Party, great. If you want to bring these ideas into the Conservative Party, great. We want to challenge, if those people, because there are a lot of people who say, well, we're spiritual there, fine. Let's take your spiritual values seriously. And that means put love ahead of money. Okay. And that's quite a challenge to the Republicans, but it's also a challenge to the Democrats, who often get funded by the same corporations that the Republicans do.
And we have time to take another call, so we'll go to the caller who's been waiting. Good morning, you're on there.
Good morning to you all. Very nice to hear this conversation this morning. Rabbi Lerner, I'm just beginning to read a book that is also fairly new out, and it's called Opus Dei. And for listeners who are unfamiliar, it is a subset of the Catholic Church.
Yes.
And people who read the Da Vinci Code may be somewhat familiar with it. And this book looks to, it's by a Vatican reporter or someone who covers the Vatican, and it looks to kind of present an objective view of the organization. And I'm just in the introduction of it, but they seem to express very strongly an idea that I heard you talk about maybe 20 minutes ago, and that's the incorporation of spirituality into their practice of daily life.
Yes.
It's not a religious order. It's incorporating the values into your work, your play, how you interact with your kids, how you interact with, you know, shop clerks that you're buying food from or buying whatever else from.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious, is that similar to, my perception is that's similar to what you were saying, and if that's the case, do you feel there's anything special about Opus Dei that has enabled them to enjoy the success that they have thus far? Is there anything unique about it, or is it just something that political progressives haven't picked up on but could sort of mimic?
Well, I wouldn't want to mimic Opus Dei, because Opus Dei has a long history of association with fascist causes. And they were supportive of Franco in Spain. They were some of their leaders were deeply involved with the fascist movements in other parts of Europe. And I would be very cautious about getting involved with them. But, you know, here's the thing. So, you know, you could then turn around and say, well, doesn't that show you the dangers of being spiritual? Well, yeah, you know, we can make the same argument about the left. You know, we're talking about fair distribution of wealth, guess who else talked about that? Stalin, the Soviet communists who ended up killing millions and millions and millions of people, including many, many millions of decent communists who were killed by Stalin. They also had that same language. So I don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater here. There are a lot. Opus Dei, they have some good ideas about the integration of spirituality in daily life, and they've got some very bad ideas about politics, so I don't want to say I'm aligned with them. Mm-hmm. But you know, you can learn from a lot of different people, and I learn from all kinds of people whom I don't agree with on fronts A, B, C, D, and E, but on front F I can learn something, or front G or front H I can learn something. So I believe that a wholesome progressive movement has to encourage people to develop an inner life. Has to, and not put it down, but on the contrary, encourage it. And say to people, it's important to develop your own spiritual resources, your own psychotherapy. You need to work on self, and we need to have a movement that takes seriously developing an inner life, just as it takes seriously the transformation of American society. But I don't want to, I don't think Opus Dei is going to get behind, for example, one of the points of the spiritual platform that I'm putting forward in my book, The Left Hand of God, Taking Back Our Country from the Religious Right, the one that calls for a social responsibility amendment to the Constitution. This social responsibility amendment that I'm proposing says that every corporation with an income of more than $50 million a year must get a new corporate charter once every 10 years. And that new corporate charter will only be granted to corporations that can prove a satisfactory history of social responsibility to a jury of ordinary citizens. See, because we're not going to trust some regulatory body, because we always know that the regulators end up in bed with those who are supposed to be regulating. So this part of creating social responsibility through the social responsibility amendment and challenging the selfishness of the corporations, you're not going to find that from the reactionary parts in the spiritual movement, and I don't think Opus Dei is going to be supporting that kind of move.
Well, thank you for your answer.
Thank you, and we only have a few minutes with you, Rabbi Lerner, so maybe we can take one quick call and then have you conclude.
One very quick call, if we do.
Good morning. Thank you for waiting.
Good morning. Rabbi, I just wanted to say that the war that you talked about, the spiritual war, started in heavenly places, and it's being waged there as well as here on earth. And that people, first of all, the weapons of our warfare is carnal. And therefore, and I think you're saying that, is that people that are not spiritual try to pull us under the law of condemnation. And we should... as religious people, we know to stay under grace. And so what I'm trying to say in essence is that the weapons of our warfare has already been described by Paul on what we need to do to pull down strongholds, and it's not carnal. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to just, you know, put that out. I know a lot of people out there that ain't spiritual don't understand what we're talking about.
Well, you know, from my reading of the Bible, and everybody's entitled to their own, that the prophets, the great prophets, and Jesus and others, they talked about an integration of two levels. They had both an inner relationship with God, but they also said when you're faced with your neighbor, you have to love your neighbors yourself, and you have to love the stranger. That's a command in Torah. And act as you love the stranger. And when they come at you with aggression, you have to turn the other cheek. You go for nonviolence. Jesus was a great pioneer of nonviolence. In other words, we can't only have an inner relationship to God. We also have to have an embodiment of God-like behavior in the way that we treat our fellow human beings, and recognize that turning the other cheek, ending poverty and oppression, is part of what it means to live a spiritual life.
I agree with that. But, you know, one last thing. I don't think, though, that I think it's the work of the enemy, or Satan in this instance, for Christians for toleration, to tolerate a spirit of homosexuality. I don't think we need to tolerate Satan. I don't think Christians need to tolerate anything that Satan do. I think it's the duty of every Christian, because it is a battle, to bring down and destroy the works of the devil.
Okay.
That includes homosexuality.
Excellent. Okay, well, thank you for calling. In 30 seconds, respond.
Yeah. Well, you know what the Bible says? It says, thou shalt not lie with a man the way you lie with a woman. It doesn't say thou shalt not lie with a man. It says, don't do it the way you lie with a woman. So those words aren't there superfluous. They're there to tell you that if you're going to lie with a man, you have to do it in a special way, in a way that... So be a Bible literalist. It's so funny to hear all these people who think they're Bible literalists and take the Bible seriously. But when the Bible says that the wealth should be redistributed every 50 years with a jubilee in which you go back to the original distribution, I don't see these people quoting Bible anymore. They're all upset about homosexuality, which I'm not upset about because I think it's another form of manifestation of love, but when it comes to the redistribution of wealth that the Bible ordains, they're suddenly not Bible literalists anymore, and that's something that I want to challenge. But I also want to say that, yes, we have to challenge the right in my view, its misuse of the Bible. We also have to challenge the left in its failure to understand spirituality, but mostly and centrally, we have to challenge the bottom line of selfishness and materialism in this society and build a spiritual left. And I hope people can come with me to make that happen by building local chapters here in Portland and in Oregon, by coming to our national conference, by going to our website, www.spiritualprogressives.org, and by buying this book, The Left Hand of God, Taking Back Our Country from the Religious Right. And I'll be at Powell's 7:30 on Tuesday night. Hope to see you there and talk more and sign books for you.
Absolutely. And not only will he be at Powell's on March 7th, but he will also be at Portland State University at 1 p.m. Smith Ballroom in the Smith Center. Come.
And tonight I'm going to be in Eugene.
Beth Israel and Eugene.
Well, thank you so much. We've only touched the surface. We haven't gone into the points of the covenant, which is really important.
But you get to come back by phone if possible.
Oh, well, I'd be delighted to be back with you.
Right.
But meantime, please get I hope people read this book because I think it will really help to develop a successful and powerful transformative movement.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And now we're going to move on over. Because after all, we are your community connection. Stay tuned for the Old Mo Variety Hour.
KBOO Portland, KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9, the Old Mo Variety Hour. Topics include the Brazilian landless workers movement and how the concept of imperialism is perceived by the anti-war movement. At 10, hear a special hour-long version of Monday on the Environment. Host Scott Forrester's guest, our Oregon activist, Harry Lonsdale, speaking about campaign finance reform, and attorney Dan Meek on PGE. At 11, Democracy Now! Looks at Iraqi women visiting the United States, and Michael Eric Dyson on Hurricane Katrina and the Color of Disaster. Also tune in tonight at 10 for KBOO's weekly poetry show, Talking Earth. Hear a reading by Daisy Zamora, one of the most celebrated poets in Nicaragua, a former Sandinista fighter, and a former minister in the Sandinista government.